Welcome to the Law Shit You Should Know podcast. We're here to talk a little bit about the law
and a whole lot about nothing. Every week, we have a new guest to discuss current events, legal drama, and dive even deeper into
the Law Shit You Should Know. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Law Shit You Should Know with Alina Santana
and Leslie Marenko.
And today we have Sakai Jacobs with us today. Hi, Kai.
Hi, everybody.
Tell us what you do. Tell everybody who's listening.
Okay, my name is Kai Jacobs. I'm the owner and founder of a law firm called South Florida Business Law Group, and we help businesses when they have to go to court so they can go back to making money.
I love it. That's good. So what kind of clients do you deal with usually, Kai?
So we've got a variety of clients. We've got businesses. We've got large businesses. Publicly traded, privately held, family owned, mom and pop shops, and then we have a lot of individuals. There are people who have business needs and business interests. The vast majority of what we do is based upon contracts, one form or another. Busted real estate deals, distributorship agreements, non-compete agreements, buy-sell agreements, asset purchase agreements. At the base of just about everything we do is some version of a contract. We're not niched down into one particular kind of contract. Contracts are contracts, and really it's about who gave what for what, and all of our lawsuits are really about one of two things: either a misplaced event in time or two people disagree as to what one particular event.
What do you mean by misplaced event in time?
So there should have been something that happened on a particular date. Like I have one particular like lawsuit where the entire dispute is about a 6-hour window of time. Was the contract formed in that 6-hour window of time? Or was it not?
The formation.
Yes.
As opposed to like the act that the contract was about. Did
right.
you deliver my boat on time? Did I purchase whatever within as many dates? You're talking about, was it formed?
Was it even a contract?
Right. They're going, the entire lawsuit is about, was there even a contract?
Oh, okay. Got it.
Wasn't there a great case, the Lady Gaga with the dogs case? Right? Do you remember this? Do you know what I'm talking about? No.
Or she had the dogs kidnapped?
Yeah, the dogs were kidnapped. And then what? There was a whole question.
Yes.
There was a whole question about whether she had made a contract with
yes.
the public about the reward
wait, tell
money.
Me, tell me, tell
okay,
me.
Okay, so Lady Gaga had some, I don't remember what her dogs were. Lady Gaga had
two
dogs.
French bulldogs.
The French bulldogs.
Very expensive French bulldogs.
They're so ugly.
Hey,
oh,
I got
them. So ugly, those dogs. Okay, anyway.
They're so ugly, they're cute.
And they're so ugly, they're expensive is what it is. Like Mark Anthony, he's so ugly. You can find him attractive. I hear.
Please
anyway.
Send all hate mail directly.
Anyway.
So she had these cute little French bulldogs, and they got stolen, and so she put out a reward. I don't remember how much the reward was for. Something obnoxious, because she played.
That was like $20,000-$25,000.
Yeah, it was a lot of money. It was well into the five figures.
I expect at least $20,000 if I return your dog, Lady Gaga.
Okay, well, the point is she offered a reward, and then the person who stole them tried to return them to claim the reward.
They said,
right.
Oh, I
and
love
so
it.
The whole question was whether or not she had formed a contract with this woman, whether this person who was dealing in unclean hands, as we call it, actually is
right.
able to collect this reward.
But the underlying presence of that contract would have been an illegal act. So
correct. So it would have been void avenue.
Oh, okay, I mean, come on. Yeah, all right.
But it went. I think it wasn't just a woman.
But how do we know
that
she stole it? How do we know she stole the dogs?
Well, I mean, I think she got caught, and then she's like, okay, here's a dog. Now
yeah,
give me my money.
Give me my money.
Was this in Miami-Dade County?
No, but it could have been.
Definitely
could have
been.
By the
definitely
way, if you
been.
Want to make a quick $10,000, there's a missing cat in South Miami,
oh,
and they've got a reward sign up for $10,000.
Oh, is that the cat that's suing me? Okay, it's a different podcast. What is happening here?
There's an orange cat.
Okay, so... So let's talk contracts. Let's talk. You said
okay.
real estate. That doesn't happen, right? Like
no.
real estate issues in South Florida.
No, fraud Lauderdale. No, no.
Fraud
Lauderdale. I like that. Tell us about that, Kai. What kind of contract issues do you see with real estate that end up with you? Because you're not a real estate attorney. Right?
No, I mean, no. I don't do closings.
Right.
But when they go sideways, they land on my desk.
Right.
And in the last few years, really in particular since COVID. When all of a sudden there were waves of people moving into Florida, and those of you who've tried to buy a house in the last 4 or 5 years have found it to be impossible. So prices have escalated, and this happened for a while there, a few times a week. It still happens with a lot of frequency, I suppose. So you buyer sellers get into a contract, and the buyers will place their initial escrow deposit, and depending on the value of the house, it's $5,000, $10,000, $20,000, $25,000. Sellers find a week later somebody else who wants to buy the property for a lot more money. and they say, hey, I found another buyer. And they
simply,
and so they'll terminate the contract. And they'll, like, they'll sign the little cancellation and release form, and they'll say, I'm happy to give you your escrow money back, now go away. And they think that they're going to get away with it.
They're so kind.
Well, and then there's some people who think that they're being generous by saying, oh, and of course I will pay all of your closing costs.
Right.
You know, send me that. And so they think that they're just going to give back escrow money, give away a few thousand dollars. But it's now, the case law has not really evolved very much, but most people haven't paid a lot of attention to it. And what the measure of damage is if you're the buyer, you say, well, wait a minute, I was going to buy this house. Now I got to go up the street and I got to pay for something else.
Right.
So the traditional model has been, oh, well, I can go pay for this other more expensive house and I will sue you for the difference in value. But that gets into a very messy, expensive proposition.
I was going to say, who's paying all the attorney's fees in this shit show?
Well, you're litigating, and of course, we'll get into prevailing parties later on, but you're still litigating, well, I don't know, does it have the same number of bedrooms? Well, is the roof in the same condition? Does it have a septic tank? Is it on sewer?
But so, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but you can get out of a real estate contract at certain intervals or if you do certain things wrong, right?
Yes, but usually those things are spelled out in the contract.
Right, correct.
So if
the appraisal sucks, the inspection's trash,
well,
whatever.
So there's, in a lot of these agreements, there's a financing contingency.
Yes.
Okay. If you don't end up qualifying for contingency, that's it. The deal is considered dead. But that's stated on the face of the agreement.
Right.
If the property doesn't appraise, the contract's for $600,000, but the appraisal came back at $560,000. You have the option to work it out, buyer and seller, but if you don't, then the contract dies. You get your money back, everybody goes away. This is different. This is,
I've
hired movers, I've quit my job, and the seller says, hey, thanks, but, you know, these people up the street are showing up with a briefcase full of money, and they're going to give me more money, and they don't need any contingencies to close, and I get to take this money and go home tomorrow. Goodbye. So in those instances...
And they're stupid enough to say that.
Well, I was about to say, it's just a situation where the person's dumb. I mean, frankly...
Because Alina clearly would just blame it on the one termite she just found.
I'm like, I found the termite. Peace!
But that's great if you're the buyer.
Right.
If you're the seller, what would your excuse be? So sellers come up with all kinds
of... but buyers do all kinds of shit. Excuse me. Well, they're late on crap. They ask for extensions that you don't have to give if you don't want to.
Well,
so
here's what happens. You're right. And so sellers will often come up with some sort of, you know, excuse.
I could come up with like 10 right now.
And then the buyers end up not doing anything at that moment. They end up going along and buying another property, not moving.
Sure.
But all purchases and sales are publicly recorded.
Right.
They go on to the Miami-Dade County Property Appraiser's website in 3 weeks, and there's a deed to someone else. That's not that hard to figure out, folks.
But so maybe that guy didn't mind the termites.
Look, I mean...
But they end up suing, and the measure of damages is not what I lost, which is, well, it is the measure of what you lost. It's, I had to pay for this. I put in escrow money, which you were gracious enough to give back. Maybe you did or didn't give me back my closing costs, but you ended up selling to the new buyer for $80,000 more.
Mm-hmm.
That's my measure of damages. The measure of what I could have sold that house for, I can now nail down on a date you in fact did sell it. So that, and there's a body of case law that supports it. I have convinced sellers to sell to my buyers a number of times because of that, and we've managed to stop a number of lawsuits from having to take place at all by telling sellers, you're going to have to sell to me. You can go sell to that person up the street, which may be what you're up to, and maybe it's not what you're up to, but if you do, this is what you're going to end up writing a check to my client for, not just escrow money. And that saved a number of deals.
I hear so many missed opportunities here. So,
well, there's always missed opportunities.
Allegedly.
So for
what
everyone
are you
listening,
about?
If you got yourself out of a contract somehow, or someone got you out of contract, you need to go check the property appraiser's website for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
This is what I've learned in this conversation.
If your seller all of a sudden decides that he or she or it is no longer going to sell to you, pay attention. Because
they just pulled one over on you people.
It's escalated in a way that like I'm prepared to put it like as a frequently asked question on my firm's website.
It's an FAQ.
Like I get this a lot.
Interesting.
Wow.
I mean, I know a lot of contracts fall through. I never really thought about that side of it though, like actually going back and suing. I feel like people find an excuse. I guess there are a lot of dumb realtors out there. Excuse me to the realtors, but there's a lot of dumb realtors out there.
This really isn't based on anything the realtor did or didn't do. What often happens?
Well, the realtor.
Who do you think brought that buyer with that suitcase of cash?
Well, okay.
I mean, listen. So my husband has a realty, right? And I hear some of the things that other realtors, especially, will tell him. And I sit there like, why would they ever say that? Like, if you were a realtor, why would you ever come to
like
someone and be like, hey, look, we got $50,000 extra, so bye. Like, are you dumb? Like. There's so many ways people violate contracts.
Well, no. There are.
You can find legitimate reasons and contracts.
There certainly are. I will say this, though. In none of the cases that I've had to get involved, with the exception of one, was this because the realtor encouraged the person to do
it. Okay, well, all right.
Now,
okay.
That said, I just did get a case where by the time it got to me, the realtor had already been disciplined by the state.
Okay.
Oh!
And
but I hear I'm unfairly bashing realtors. I apologize to all the realtors.
You know, I'm gonna say that phrase that everybody hates about lawyers, you know. It depends. You know, the circumstances of your case may or may not be different, but there are enough scrupulous and well-meaning realtors who I can tell from like the way, because we get the communications in the course of the lawsuit, and they let their clients know, tell them, don't do this.
Well,
don't do this.
Meanwhile, all of this costs money. How do people even pay you for all this shit?
I'm a very practical person.
Yeah.
And I want to know who's paying all of your... I know you're not a cheap guy, Kai. You are very sophisticated.
Kai is not free.
He is not pajarito lawyer. Do not call him for pajarito things or if you have no money. So who ends up paying you, Kai, and to what extent is it worth it? So there's $80,000, back to the $80,000.
I mean, that seems like it might be worth it.
That's a little bit of money.
$10,000 would be worth
it. It's a little bit of money. Right. No, $10,000 is not worth shit, bro. Like, so... Right. So I am also not Pajarito the lawyer, for the record. So, yes, Kai.
Okay. Let me start with an important qualifier. I am, in fact, cheap. I'm just not inexpensive.
There is a difference.
Put that aside. So... The standard form purchase and sale contracts used by the vast majority of real estate lawyers in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
It's a standard form. There's a Florida bar, there's a realtor's form, and it's an as-is purchase and sale. They all include a prevailing party attorney's fees provision.
Okay.
Winner takes the fee. I should also point out...
Cue the Avison.
I should...
I almost started singing there.
I should point out, though, that those agreements also have what I consider to be a brilliant effort to stop that whole train from leaving the station, which is they have a mandatory pre-suit mediation requirement.
Okay.
That before you can sue, you must go to mediation.
Okay.
And I forget which of the two forms it is, but it's section 16B of one of them. And, you know, you hire a certified mediator, so that conversation always remains confidential.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those cases get worked out. And so, before you spend $10,000, $12,000, whatever it takes to recover $80,000, you go to mediation and hopefully you spend a few hundred. And, you know, the reality is in litigation in my world, the issue of attorney's fees, it's really a bargaining position. You know, when people start talking about in settlements or judgments, I want my attorney's fees, I'm going to get my attorney's fees, that usually becomes the thing that kills the transaction or the deal or the arbitration or the mediation or the judgment negotiation. Well, we'll wipe out the attorney's fees if you just write me a check for the money you should have in the first place. And that's very often the way it ends up. And some people play all the way to the end and they say, no, I've got a large attorney's fee award here I can get and I'm going to go get it and I don't care if I don't collect it. And the conversation then, often is, oh, my client doesn't have the money and you'll never get it. They're judgment proof. They'll file bankruptcy. And
good luck with that.
It's the same thing every time. I mean, we go to mediation. I hear this conversation all the time. But what people who are buyers or sellers, you know, who are looking at that scenario should always keep in mind is a judgment is good for 20 years.
Yeah.
So you may not have the money today.
That's a long time.
But you will have to say, I'm going to intentionally impoverish myself
for the next two decades
in order not to pay you $10,000, $12,000, whatever dollars.
Yeah.
And that's not really a good way to live, because what very often happens...
In poverty? No.
Yeah. Is,
with everybody else holding all your money?
Yeah.
It's messy, it's complicated, and it's just, you know... And then you turn it over to judgment collection lawyers who do this stuff on a contingency.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, they'll just open the floodgates and come after you. So I don't ever tell people, well, you know, you'll never collect the money, because that's not really the way to go about it. It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
And that attorney's use conversation is always something that's so important in every negotiation and any, okay, do we sue? And in a consult, I imagine, in a strategy session, looking at the case before they ever spend an obscene amount of money to go into litigation.
Yeah. How does that work, Kai? I think you told us before we started the podcast today that there was some case you were working on or some judgment you recently got about this. Tell us about that.
So I was involved in, I was representing a landlord. Significant amount of rent at issue. This wasn't, you know, a couple thousand dollars. It was a big home with a lot of money. And my client was owed a lot of rent. And as the case went on, I inherited the case. We realized we were exceeding the jurisdictional amount that the court was going to award us. So we asked the court to allow us to remove the case from county court to circuit court. The judge said no, she wanted to push it to trial. So we said we will voluntarily dismiss the lawsuit without prejudice and we will refile in circuit court. And the other attorney, who, smart guy, was aggressive, filed a motion, said, I am, and the magic words are, the prevailing party. Mm-hmm. You know, we always hear this, the prevailing party statute, the prevailing party. I'm the prevailing party. And he came armed to his motion and the ultimate hearing with the general body of law that says, even if you dismiss a lawsuit without prejudice, you are the prevailing party and you are entitled to attorney's fees, even if the other side goes and refiles the action. And that's what we did. So they felt pretty good about their position. And we went to the court and we pulled out the landlord-tenant statute and we pulled out the standard form realtor's contract, which, by the way, which is why everybody in the world should use it. It doesn't say prevailing party. It says the attorney's fees go to the party that get a judgment or a decree in their favor against the non-prevailing. And, you know, they argued that that was splitting hairs. And, you know, I'm not going to bore anybody with, like, you know, the deep, you know, history and research of how these statutes evolved. But there are a few statutes out there that differ from this general prevailing party statement and make it very clear that it's you're not just, quote unquote, the prevailing party. There has to be some other condition that has to be fulfilled. Both the landlord-tenant statute and the standard realtor's contract in a lot of cases, and in this particular case, this lease, which is also the standard lease form, require that you get a judgment or a decree entered in your favor, and the judge agreed with us. And we relied on a case out of, we were in the 4th District, and it's Ortuzar versus Foley was the case we relied on, which is a 5th District court, which is further up the coast. And it was exactly the same case. She agreed. She said there's no attorney's fees, and they appealed that decision. And they hired appellate counsel. We went through the whole dance again, and the 4th District Court of Appeal agreed with us. And they said, yeah, there are some other statutes, and based upon this authority, Ortuzar is now going to be the law of the 4th District. So now we've got two districts in the state of Florida that, you know, if you voluntarily dismiss your lawsuit based upon your lease and the landlord-tenant statute, the other side is not going to be the prevailing party.
Very cool. Super cool.
We just got the mandate handed down in that case a couple weeks ago, so that's now the final word on that.
Nice. What about the other districts? They just don't have any case law.
So the 5th agrees with that. Nobody else has exactly ruled on that.
Okay.
Now, it's possible that one day, you know, one court will certify a conflict and maybe the 3rd DCA will say differently. Yep. or, you know, the second, and it'll end up before the Supreme Court of Florida.
Right.
You know, they, you know, I don't really know what the state of what the U.S. District Court judges have to say about this. But they follow the general proposition that if you voluntarily dismiss your lawsuit under Florida state law, the other side is the prevailing party, even if that dismissal is without prejudice and you file and you refile your action.
Interesting. So the short answer, I think, to the question I started out with is...
It depends.
So let's say whoever loses the fight is what this all comes back to, essentially.
Well, so... No, I mean, you know, I get this all the time. People, when they call and they want to know about their lawsuit, they want to know what their range is, the question always comes, can I get back my attorney's fees? I want to sue for attorney's fees. And we follow this thing called the American rule. And America is sort of in the minority position in this. If you, depending on where you are in Europe, like attorney's fees are just assumed. You lose, like you're betting the farm.
And
if
when you say
lose.
American, you mean U.S., not necessarily all of... I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
you don't mean
America,
Central America.
You don't mean Guatemala.
No,
you don't
I,
mean means the Western hemisphere, you know?
I mean, I might. I don't know, but I don't practice
okay,
in these countries, so
maybe. I'm sorry.
This is the only America that matters.
But,
I don't know what you're going.
Again, hate mail directly, Leslie.
So,
the American rule. We don't mean...
Okay.
But what they mean by that is the American versus either a European rule or some
you.
Other. So in America, it is everybody
America.
Bears... Their own costs and attorney's fees incurred in litigation.
Okay.
With two notable exceptions. If you have a contract that says so,
right.
Which means the parties bargained for and
right.
gave consideration for the idea that, well, if we have to fight about this.
Yeah.
And you can call it prevailing party, there are those words again, will recover his, her, or its attorney's fees. And or you have a statute that allows for the recovery of attorney's fees.
Sure.
You know, Title VII, the
wage and hour,
the landlord-tenant statutes, and
the old
and
first
that.
Party.
Now,
sorry, guys.
Right, the first party. And there are now Florida has what's called mandatory reciprocity, meaning you can write into your contract, oh, if I, the lender, have to come and sue you, the borrower, to come and collect my money, I and only I will be the only party to ever be able to recover my attorney's fees, even if you win, so be it. And you agree to that.
Wow, all right.
That's unenforceable.
That's what I thought.
So under 57-105, the law says you can write that if you want to.
That's cute.
But they will always.
That's nice. That's nice. But what's good for the goose?
That's very sweet. But it's not going to work that way. It's always going to be mutual.
Right. You want to play that game? We're going to play the game.
So,
but it's a deterrent, right? To put this in contracts, I would imagine.
Yeah, because, I mean, how many people who don't
right,
practice
yeah,
law necessarily
don't
know that?
Right.
And so, you know, it's there to encourage a certain kind of behavior. And as much as it's always, you know, reciprocal, there are exceptions where some courts are not keen to enforce it. Title VII being, I'm not an employment lawyer per se,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, where it's popped up in my cases, you know, defendants can win, but judges are reluctant to then go, you know, pound on the potentially discriminated against person. Like, oh, and now you're going to go pay the attorney's fees for all of that if you in good faith brought your lawsuit. So,
yeah.
But it is reciprocal. And so it is the exception, not the rule. Now, in the course of litigation, I tell clients, I say, there's another way to handle this, too. When you come to me and say, we're going to sue under some traditional common law cause of action, misrepresentation, tortious interference with a business relationship, breach of contract that does not include an attorney's fees provision, I said, there is a way, as litigation progresses, to try to recover your attorney's fees,
mm-hmm.
and that becomes an active deterrent to certain behaviors and becomes a bargaining tool as you get closer to the end of the case. And that's called the formal proposal for settlement. And everyone's like, yeah, I know what a settlement is. Yeah, but this is a tool. It's not me sending an email to the other lawyer that says, you know, give me 2 bushels of weed and 6 pizzas and the case is resolved.
And you can have back your cow.
No, right. It's a weird formalized and... You know, for law geeks, like this was a thing where the Supreme Court, like there was this conflict for years, is this a procedural tool or a substantive tool? And decided it was both. So there's a statute, 768-79,
uh-huh.
It talks about the formal proposal, and then Florida Rule of Civil Procedure 1.442 that says this is how you have to do it. And what it is it is a written document, and it says, I am offering settlement to you on the following terms. And you also have to include all of these other things. Does it or does it not include attorney's fees? Does it or does it not resolve anything for punitive damages? And then it has to be transmitted. They have to be given a certain amount of time to respond, 30 days. And if they accept it, then you follow the settlement, the case is done. But if they don't, on that 30th day is when the clock starts ticking. And if you litigate that case all the way to the end, and let's just make up round of numbers, and you know, you offered $10,000 to resolve the lawsuit,
mm-hmm.
and then the other side wins, but they only recovered $6,000 in attorney's fees, and they didn't come within the 25% margin, they still have to pay your attorney's fees.
Ooh. Mm-hmm. For failing to settle.
Right. For
wasting all of our time.
A penalty for digging around.
It's, yeah, it's, you know, you're wasting everybody's time and money.
It's a waste of judicial
and
resources.
This is the fuck around and find out.
It's the fuck around and find out
rule. Fuck around and find out rule. I like that.
And
like
you
that.
Should have done your homework. You should have properly assessed your case. And there's a price to be paid for that. Now, they're pretty strictly construed. Like, you make a couple of mistakes and you can be out of court. You also can't, you know, offer some ridiculous number.
Right.
You know, you can't offer $5. You know, that's considered a de minimis, nonsensical offer. So, those don't work. But if it's a good faith number, and I've had them enforced. I mean, they work if you come up with a reasonable number and they don't beat it at trial.
I hate to ask this, but what's a reasonable number? Who determines the reasonable?
It depends.
Number.
So, well, you know, look, every case is different.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, if reasonable. You know, if I offer $10,000 in case A where there's only $50,000 at stake, that's very different than offering $10,000 where $1 million is at stake.
Right.
So, you know, what we often do with clients, particularly at mediation, is, or beforehand, actually, we'll sit down and we'll say, what is the real scope of liability? Now we've gone through the pleading, we've managed a good part of the discovery. What are we really looking at so that we can make honest assessments as to what this case is worth? Because I really push to try to get cases mediated early versus later. And then based upon that, if it doesn't settle, we basically just take that number and use that. And either we'll take a little bit off, we'll add a little bit to it. And, you know, that way it also communicates to the other side. Like, we very seriously believe that this is a true
yeah.
number as to what this case should resolve for, and you are now at risk. And it does change the way people play the game. Knowing that you are at risk for the recovery of attorney's fees when you were not it before is a very different way to litigate when you have that in your back pocket.
You mentioned mediation. Kai, how many of your cases would you say actually settle in mediation? Give or take.
So.
And how many times do you regret it?
Well, I mean, you know, so I've never been a part of mediation. It's just not part of what I do at all. And I've thankfully never had to experience one in my personal life. But I can imagine that there are a lot of really angry people with these lawsuits. And I'm not sure how putting them all in the room together somehow magically works. And they all get along and
there's
my eye.
There's separate rooms. You gotta separate them.
I mean, I this concept is
it depends on
I'm the skeptical.
So it depends. It's interesting that you raise it that way because
I'm angry enough to fucking sue you. Like, you gotta make me really angry.
Well, here's there's a lot to unpack there. There's a lot to unpack there.
I mean,
so
I'm not a quick trigger when it comes to this, I guess.
No, but
too,
let's...
But.
So, unlike divorce, where, you know...
Sure.
There's a whole other
dynamic going
on.
There's a whole
like,
other.
For instance, if you have a... Like, as much as I'm a business litigator, sometimes these are family members...
Sure, yeah.
...pounding on each other.
Absolutely.
Those, oddly... get treated like family law cases at mediation, where you never actually see the other side. So a traditional mediation, in a business litigation mediation before COVID, yeah, we would all go down to either somebody's attorney's office, they would
yeah,
come to my office.
I pictured a conference room.
Or, right, and we would sit in a conference room. The mediator would sit at the head of the table, and he or she would have the plaintiffs on one side, the defendants on the other, And I've taken the mediation training for circuit court, so, you know, I mean, I know the speech. You know, I'm a mediator. This is a confidential discussion. Nothing we talk about will ever leave this room. And I'm here to see if we can't resolve this case today. Because if you don't, you're going to spend money and all of this stuff. And so,
yada, yada, yada.
Then he or she lets everybody tell their tale of woe. You know, the plaintiffs get to do their opening, the defendants get to do their opening, and everybody's got their own different idea about how that should
area
go.
Area of the grievances.
Yeah.
This is a Seinfeld, yada, is, yada, yada, area yes. of the grievances. I'm on a roll. I'm on a roll with the Seinfeld reference.
So, you know, in business contexts, the lawyers will always tell their clients, say nothing. Do not turn this into some, you know, I'm right, you're wrong. Like, it's you're never going to go anywhere. You're giving them free testimony.
But do they listen to you?
I've never had a problem. I've been very really? Fortunate that my clients have always.
He has like a taser.
It's a cattle prod. Like, whatever.
I mean, I guess maybe I would listen. Like, I'm just putting myself in this position, right? If you were in a lawsuit and you represented,
don't ever accept a leader.
I mean, I actually am angry enough to go as far as suing you. I'm pissed,
but,
right? Like,
right.
I want to tell you to fuck off to
yes,
your face.
And
like, she can't wait to get to me.
I can't wait. Shove your offer up your ass, you know.
But here's what I do tell clients. So I tell them, I said, look, there are you watch a lot of TV, you see movies, and they say, you know, I'm going to go to trial and it's my day in court. And I tell them,
aww, how cute.
Isn't that adorable
also
of you?
So cute.
That's so sweet.
Also
I go,
so cute.
I go, that's not your day in court. That's my day in court.
You get to sit down and
shut I said, your trial is a beauty pageant. All right? You wear what I tell you. You sit over there. You go twirl the baton when I tell you to. You wear the right colored evening dress and you answer the world peace question the right way. And don't startle anybody too much and we might make it to the top 10. That's what we're hoping for. This is not your day to get on the stand and tell your story. Similarly,
that's right.
Your deposition is not your day to tell your story.
But isn't this the
that's
foundation
right.
of the American legal
oh,
system?
You're
no.
fucking with my idealism, Kai.
we're gonna need another podcast episode. So,
come on.
We need a whole other episode for that. But
maybe because of what I do for a living, but part of what I do is putting people on the stand to tell their story. Like, there's something to be said for that.
You do get to tell your story. But what you can't do is bring all of your emotions onto the stand with you.
Oh, but who's emotionless if you're suing someone?
Well,
no
you're not. You're not. But there are, and I tell clients, especially when it's time to get
yeah.
on the stand for trial or deposition, I said, look, the reason we answer questions in particular ways is it's not like they tell you on TV. I'm not here to be tricky. I'm not here to be cute. We're not here to skirt the truth. We want this to be done in the fastest, most efficient way possible. If we go down some rabbit hole of you being angry or upset, it's only going to lead to more and more and more questions, and we're going to get away from the thing we came into court about. And by the way, you show up to a trial. I mean, I had a three-day jury trial. We walked into the courtroom. The plaintiff looks at me and says, why are we doing a jury trial? He's a friend of mine. I said, I don't know, dumbass. You signed
you're
up for this. And he says, I inherited this case from the other lawyers before you inherited your side. I said, then why are we standing here? And the judge looked at us and he says, yeah, why are you guys standing here? He goes, you guys want to do this on Zoom? We're like, oh, yeah. We said, but I think we're going to need 3 days. He says, if you're going to do this in non-jury trial, he goes, I'm getting this done in 8 hours. So be ready. And that's the way it works, which is why we tell clients, you can't just get up there and, like, let it all go. Anyway, now we've completely wandered from the point of mediation.
No, but
that's,
this is good.
At deposition, I tell them, you know, that's not your day. Like, that is the worst day of your case.
Yes.
When you show up, I, as your lawyer, have the least amount of control, authority, and power in the room. All I can say is, objection to form. I can get you. You still have to answer the question.
That is your cue to think about what the fuck is about to come out of your mouth.
Right. It is. Yeah, that's about right. And then, you know, I can only stop you if you are about to divulge an attorney client, an accountant client, or some physician client, you know, privileged information. Other than that, you got to answer the question, even if it's got nothing to do with the case. I mean, limitations within reason, of course, but it's not, you know, it's they get to ask a much broader range of questions than they would, and I just get to sit there and say, objection to form. It's not an ideal environment, and you are going to walk out of your deposition feeling the worst you have felt about your case since the day it was filed. And that's the way they all go. But I tell them at mediation, I go, oh, let your freak flag fly. All you have to do is get through opening, all right? You just sit there and smile. I said, they may say things that are meant to antagonize you. Do not fall for it because they're trying to bait you into a situation. If not, just smile, nod, and then we're going to go into separate rooms. Now, mediators are really liking the online Zoom thing because we can be all over the world, and it's great. We just go into breakout rooms. It's one of the few things I don't love about resolving cases, but that's a different discussion. And the mediator will come in and say, you can tell the mediator whatever you want. I hate the other person. They're fucking mean.
That's where Lita thrives.
I mean, I want to push sugar on the asshole.
I'm sorry.
I said, you, I go, that is your opportunity to tell them whatever you think and feel, because that, I go, them, that's the mediator's job. The mediator's job is to take all of that and figure out when the mediator goes in the other room.
What the fuck?
And here's the same thing. And, you know.
Because everybody's bad shit.
All that bitch wants to do is kill me. I'm gonna fuck her up in court. Like, that's, I'm gonna take all of her money. I don't care if they have anything. I'm gonna kill their dog. Like, all kinds of stuff. And the mediator's job, you know, and I hear mediators talk and they say, oh, well, if everybody leaves unhappy, it's a good settlement. And I don't buy that. You know, a mediator's job is not to get people to like some critical point where it's gonna break down. A mediator's job is to find where people's interests overlap and try to create agreement out of that. And it's interesting that as much as people's pleadings will come in a lawsuit from what arguably sound like they're wildly divergent, you know, positions, like I said at the beginning, all lawsuits really are about two things. You know, a disagreement as to what an event means or a misplaced event in time. And when people really start negotiating about those two things, they really find that their interests are, it's their emotions. That's how they got into this. And it's, you know, once you can start getting people to take that out of the equation, they can start being a lot more reasonable about what they're going to do. Doesn't mean that they all settle. So to answer your question, I would tell you, probably half of my cases settle at mediation, but less than 10% of our cases ever go to trial.
Interesting. So some of them will settle after mediation?
Or before, but...
Right before trial?
You know, it's funny. It used to be that way. Like, there used to be the settlement at the courthouse steps.
Yeah.
I think the way litigation works now, people are so pot invested in what's going on, it's just so expensive that people are like, well, we've come this far. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah, fuck it. Yes. And that's my point. That would be me. That would be me. If I made it that far, like, we're fucking here. We're
but that's stuff. And that's what a lot of people do. I last year I tried a case in person and we had gone through all of the evidence. And we've been there all day. And it was it was boring. Like, this is not the kind of thing you'd want to see on TV. There were Excel spreadsheets with numbers who made what payment, and you know, and to the point that, like, because it was a non-jury trial, the judge looked at me and goes, Jacobs, what's that spreadsheet say? And we would just read out numbers. We're like, we all agree, right? He's like, I just want to be done with this. And it was going to be very complicated for him to work out a judgment. So he said at the end, done. Like, this is, he says, all right, everybody, look, it's 4:50 or whatever time it was. He said, I'm clearly not going to be able to make a decision about this today. He goes, I can tell you what my ruling will be. He goes, but I'm going to send all of you back home to figure out the numbers.
Right, right.
He said, so
you guys go start crunching some shit
for
me.
He said, so here's what I'm going to give you the opportunity to do. You can go take 10 minutes and see if you can resolve this. But you guys have been here all day. I think you know where I'm going to take this. So we all left the room. We all were like, forget it. Let's just come up with a number.
We need a number.
And all of a sudden, these people who were like, we're not speaking to each other a year and a half ago, were you know, now the clients were like, we're not paying these two bozos to go figure this out. Like, how much you got? What are you going to pay?
Right.
How fast can we pay? How right. long is this going to take?
Oh, that's hilarious.
And they were like, no, 3 months. Let's just be done with this, and here's a check, and, you know, it was...
They settled their own case all of a sudden.
And all of a sudden, they came up with their own number.
Wow.
And the other lawyer and I just got to stand there, and I got to, you know,
excellent.
Look at him, and we just, you know, shot the shit for a couple minutes, and, you know, because everybody knew what it was going to be. It was just a matter of... 10,000 this way or that way. So they came up with their own number. We're like, judge, we got it done. He's like, excellent. Send me your judgment.
Send me your judgment.
And
I love it.
That's, you know, very often how it happens. So, but the idea of it right on the courthouse steps, I've not seen nearly as much of that in the last 6 years or so. But they will settle before calendar call. They will settle after mediation when people go back. And after leaving mediation, because very often people will leave with questions, you know, I should probably look at that better. Because one of the beauties of mediation is the mediator will come in the room and get you to think about things that you weren't thinking about before, because you believe in your position. And your lawyer is paid as much as your lawyer's your counselor. They're still paid to advocate your position.
Right.
But a neutral person who does not care comes in and says, let me tell you where you got a problem.
Let me tell you where case is trash.
And
insulting. Very insulting.
And you're like, oh, okay. You know, and I'm a big believer, you know, for you non-litigators, you know, lawyers will spend, you know, weeks fighting about which mediator to use.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I want this person. I want this person. I want this person. I want to go here. And I tell my clients, I just want to let you know, I will always let the other side pick the mediator. Always. I will go wherever they want to mediate, and I will always let them pick the mediator. And they go, why would you do that? Especially like my clients out of New York and Chicago and Washington, D.C. No, we're going to do it. I said, no, we're going to do it this way. And then they always want to know why. I said, because there is nothing more effective than your hand-picked mediator walking into the room of your office telling you, your case is fucked up. And I'm like, you picked this.
Psychology.
I like it.
I find it wildly effective. Wildly effective. You know, when people come and tell me, I've had a lot of success with so-and-so. Great, let's use him or her. Great, I'm all for it. I find that to be one of the most effective tools to getting cases resolved.
Interesting.
Very cool.
Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah, after 3 decades, I've learned a couple things.
Kai, you look like a spring chicken.
Oh, this doesn't just happen.
Oh, man. All right. Tell us other stupid shit people do. So you represent business owners, right? It's the title of your damn firm.
Yes.
Okay. So tell us some stupid shit people do.
Stupid shit people do.
What
other than the suitcase of cash.
Well,
I mean.
What's that?
The suitcase of cash. Was
the suitcase of
you
cash.
Know.
What's wrong with the suitcase of
that?
Cash?
What with that?
Well, get your criminal defense lawyer, and he'll tell you why that's a problem.
That's the next podcast.
Yeah, that's Danny.
He's at two.
That's a whole. He'll tell you why that's a problem.
I mean, I don't think a suitcase full of cash inherently is an issue, but
allegedly, that's
different.
Allegedly,
no. But one of the things I see most often business owners do, and we talked about this, they appoint themselves their own registered agents.
Okay.
And in fairness. It's not that funny.
Oh, no, I can see how this is all going to go.
Wait, before you keep going, you need to tell our listening audience
what that means.
What's a registered agent?
Being a business counselor and lawyer, we represent businesses. Businesses are limited liability companies, corporations, professional associations, and partnerships, limited and all that. So if you are a business entity in any state of this country, you have to have an agent who's designated to receive service of process, meaning when you get sued and the court-appointed process server needs to go deliver these papers, which is still what we do in the 21st century, somebody has to be the designated person to receive those things.
And to be clear, every single business in the United States, no matter what they are, no matter who the owner is, has a registry agent.
Yes.
Okay.
You're
all listening, right?
if you have registered online with the Secretary of State, in whatever state you are in this country, you've got a registered agent somewhere. They may give it a different name, but you have a registered agent.
Okay.
So, in Florida, They don't, I mean, you know, they give you a little paragraph when you do it online, but nobody reads it. Nobody reads it. Nobody reads the statute as to what it means and what you have to do. And so...
I think I'm my registered agent for business.
And you start a business and, you know, you don't know anything, which is fair. You're an entrepreneur. You're just getting started. You've got a limited budget. You're already going to pay $125 to the state just to do this thing online. And you didn't stop to think, oh, who's going to do this and what are the responsibilities? I'm a registered agent. I'm going to get an email once a year to renew my company. I read my email, no problem. I'll type in myself. And... that's how I've learned most of my clients approach it.
And get defaulted.
We'll talk about how that goes sideways, yes. So then when you do get sued, you're like, well, I'm not going to get sued, so it won't be a problem. Those are my favorite clients.
Of course.
Those are my favorite clients.
Of course.
Well, but I mean, I think I'm going to defend myself here because I think I am my own registered agent, but... it's not that you don't think you're going to get sued. It's like, well, I'm the owner. I'm the one, the primary. I'm the person who's... should receive this.
Correct. That is exactly what every single person believes.
Right, right. I'm playing double advocate.
That is exactly what
they believe. But go on.
And now, you are off on vacation.
Okay,
right?
Sure. Which I do on vacation.
Which you do. You will occasionally go on vacation.
All the time. All the time. It's a miracle. This podcast is not off the ground.
So you are on vacation. You are away.
At the Galapagos.
I am. I'm in the Galapagos.
Yeah, she's not like in Orlando.
Okay. And no process server's
in
coming to get you.
In remote areas of the world.
No process server's coming to find you there. The law says, and you know, it's a fairly lengthy statute, but then if the actual registered agent is not there, there's a list of people in order that they're allowed to go serve.
Okay.
They've got to look for the president, then the vice president, and then...
okay.
Invariably...
which, by the way, the vice president is my husband, who will be in the Galapagos.
Right. So, yeah. So you know where it's going to get dumped? With the receptionist.
With the receptionist.
Now, which is fine. Maybe you have the most responsible receptionist in the world. It won't be a problem. Yeah, I know. I couldn't get in. There was nobody at the front desk. So, but then, perhaps, while you're away, your receptionist, I don't feel well. Emergency appendectomy. And then you hire some temp to sit out there. And the temp takes the papers, throws them over there, and forgets about it. You know, doesn't write down on a sticky note, hey, by the way, here's this thing you need to care about. Your receptionist comes back, goes about his or her happy little job. You come back from vacation, you feel awesome. You know, the iguanas didn't eat you. You saw a lot of blue-footed boobies. All is good.
What?
Anyway.
Watch the National Geographic Channel.
Yeah. They're little birds with bright blue
feet. Like the piranha.
This color, actually. The feet.
Yeah, they're like this color.
They're called blue-footed.
Boobies.
I'm going to Google this later for you. Go on.
We'll show you pictures.
Yeah.
So you come back, and lo and behold, a month and a half later, this piece of paper shows up on your desk that says there's a judgment entered against the law firm for all of this money. And you say, wait, what? How did that happen?
Okay.
And you go to your lawyer and you say, oh my God, Kai, look what happened. And I say, why didn't you respond to this? I didn't know about it. What do you mean?
I was in the Galapagos.
And I say, well, what we look
well,
it up.
Well, who is Michelle Gonzalez, the clown I fired a month ago?
And so sure enough, Michelle Gonzalez, we're sorry, we don't know. Anyway.
Hypothetical Michelle Gonzalez.
Allegedly.
This in no way represents an actual person. It's purely a fictional account. Any resemblance to persons living or dead are purely coincidental. So, and I say, well, now there's a judgment. There's nothing you can do. And that's it. And setting aside a default judgment is wild. And by the way, the case law says inattention
brutal.
Is not
is it really
brutal.
Inattention.
It's fucking brutal.
Once the judgment is entered, yeah. And lots of everybody thinks, oh, well, it's excusable neglect, which is one of the most important criteria. And they say, the fact that your receptionist left it on the desk and forgot to give it to you is not excusable neglect. And that's bad. So what we encourage everyone to do the second they come on board is switch over your registered agent. We do it. We do it for all of our clients so that we just have process delivered to us. Because one of the most important criteria for being a registered agent is you must be in the premises every business day between 10 and 12. If not, they can go down the list and hunt anybody else down. If the person knows I am the registered agent and the process server shows up, that is their job. And there's registered agent liability mm-hmm. if they screw that up. So that's a whole other problem for the registered agent. But it insulates the business owner.
Right.
And so that's the key. And, you know, and anyone who thinks that that's not that big a deal, I love to tell my favorite horror story.
Uh-oh.
And I had a client.
I so see myself going back to my office and changing my registry agent in the next 30 minutes. Go on.
I had a client.
Takai.
Very nice, well-meaning person. He had this vacation condo on South Beach.
Okay.
$770,000 is what he paid. Had a mortgage. And he, being a foreigner living in Colombia, created a domestic entity to own and hold the company so that he didn't have, you know, FIRTA problems if he went to try to sell it. So he didn't know any differently. He thought he was being, you know, a good business owner. I created a company, it'll be held domestically, and he appointed himself as registered agent, and he said, I'm gonna make the property address the registered agent's address.
Of course.
Because then all the mail will come there, it'll be great. It'll
be great.
And he goes back to Colombia after closing. And he says, I'm going to be a responsible property owner. I'm going to put my monthly condominium assessments on auto pay. Does that. And they pay every month. And, but then after about a year, the condo association raises the rates. And where do they send the notice? To the property address.
Interesting.
Not to him in Colombia. And if you've ever worked with condominium associations, a lot of their stuff is automated. So after a few months, when he's not paying the full amount, well,
they now own this apartment.
It goes to collection, and it goes to the attorneys, who then send out a notice of intent to file a claim of lien. Well, where do they send it? They send it to the property address. Nobody's there to get it. 30 days later, they file a claim of lien. Nobody's there to get it.
Oh, Jesus.
Then they file and sue to foreclose.
Yeah.
They foreclosed on this, and this guy is paying the same amount of money every month.
But what did they serve?
Well, here's the thing. In a foreclosure lawsuit, you can serve by publication if you can't find the registered agent.
Oh, fuck.
And get ready, everybody, because the service of process statutes are going to start changing. They're going to start allowing certain services, believe it or not, by text message and email. So get ready, because it's all going to change.
When is that?
Yeah, well, there's nothing.
They
set.
Need to do something.
So yeah, they're gonna try to make this a little more in line with the real world, but that's a different conversation. I'm waiting to see how that evolves because I'm really interested.
Hey, speed that shit
up. So they can serve by publication. Registered agent, not on site.
Mm-hmm.
No officers, managers, or members for the LLC located. They file affidavits. They file notice to the clerk. Boom, the thing goes published.
Wow.
In a newspaper.
Like
a nobody reads
physical one.
Yes, no, no. In a physical, the Daily Business Review.
Oh, God.
So do you think that my client in Columbia is thumbing through the Daily Business Review?
Sure. He gets it delivered on his front porch.
Yeah. 8 months
in
after.
Maine. In Maine.
So.
Wow.
Foreclosed. A judgment of $16,200, and they put the property up on the, because in foreclosure, the judgment says that the property will be placed for public sale
mm-hmm.
to pay off the debt.
Yes.
So they put it up for sale, and for those of you that don't know, there is a whole group of people out there in Miami-Dade who are pros at this.
Yeah.
They scan these upcoming sales, and they all work it out with each other as to who's going to bid on what for how much. So this property got sold for whatever. Certainly not $770,000. So the guy loses title to pay off the condo association for $16,000 whatever dollars. I think with attorney's fees it was $21,000 by the time it was done.
Oh my God.
But it gets worse.
How? But it doesn't end there.
But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more.
Yeah. So the bank that has the mortgage says, hey, Mr. Property Owner, you lost the collateral.
You asshole.
That's a default of the mortgage, dumbass. So now we are accelerating the debt. Here is your notice of acceleration. God. Please do us a favor and write us a check for the balance of the loan, which I think at that time was like $685,000. This guy was like beside himself. Like, he lands in the U.S., and he's like, what do you mean? He goes to his unit. Where's
my Miami Beach apartment?
His property is gone.
Somebody else is living in it.
And they're trying to serve him with this lawsuit from the bank for the debt.
Crazy.
Had this guy had the correct registered agent, none of this would have happened.
It's pretty bad. This is pretty bad. It's a good story.
That's pretty bad. That's a great story.
It's a good story.
It's terrible.
Well, that's not great for him.
That's a fucking awful story.
Great for anybody who changes the way they do things because of it, but not for him.
Wow. All right, then.
Excellent. Yeah, that was rough.
Excellent.
I have no words. I need to go fix my registry. Thank you, Kai, for that amazing horror story.
That's what I do.
Well, with that, I think we're just about at the end of our time. So, Kai, thank you so much.
You gotta come back for another podcast episode.
You do.
I will do this.
I feel like I live vicariously through you guys.
These are great stories. I love these stories. But thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem. Any final words for anyone listening to us? No?
South Florida Business Law Group. We help businesses thrive.
Awesome. And change your registry agent.
And change your registry agent, everybody.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Take care, everyone. Good to go.
Do we say,
how long was
we
that?
We don't say, and we're out.
And we're out.
And we're out. Thank you, Kai. That was
awesome. Like, we need like notice of like time. Because well, I feel like the time went out. That's the problem. That's my clock.
It's not on.
No.
Oh,
I was losing
goodness.
My mind. I kept looking at my and Kai's watch.
I feel like that went by really quick, but I assume that was.
I saw it at 1:45 and then I saw his come off.
Is
it
like battery off,
right? Yeah, we gotta plug it in is the problem. So it turned off and I was like, oh, the clock went off.
So Kai, you will have to...